This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Buddhism on Air, a weekly program on the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, presented by Tenzin Chozong, a monk in the Tibetan tradition. The program is sponsored by Yulan Zhu, Julie Wong, and the Buddha Youth Association. Hello and welcome to the second program in this series. Last week we talked generally about the Buddha's teachings and how to approach them. I ended the program outlining the four seals, as they are the basis of belief for anyone claiming to be a Buddhist. Generally it is said that you become a Buddhist when you accept the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as your ultimate refuge. For those unfamiliar with the terms Dharma and Sangha, Dharma has many meanings. But in this context, it means the collected teachings of the Buddha, especially the teachings about the end of suffering and the path that takes us there. Sangha can also mean a number of things, but when we talk about the Sangha being our refuge, we're talking specifically about the highly realized beings on the path, those who've totally understood and seen reality as it is, in contrast to how it appears to us. This will become clearer later in this series. The point I'm trying to make here is that by taking the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as our refuge, we implicitly state our belief in and acceptance of the four seals. If we say we put our refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but then dispute any of the four seals, we're not really Buddhists. So let's have a look at the four seals again. They are: all compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. All phenomena are selfless. Nirvana is peace. One of the mainstays of the Buddha's teachings is that just about everything is changing instant by instant. In fact, the Buddha said that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. You may ask what he meant by compounded phenomena. This is a very good question, as it points to the very heart of Buddha's teachings, dependent arising. Compounded phenomena means phenomena made up of other things, dependent on other things, not existing inherently. Like a table, for instance. We might look at a table and think, oh, it's just a table. But would there be a table if there were no legs or no top? You see, the table depends on being made up of other things, four pole-like pieces of wood that hold up another plane-like piece of wood. The very existence of the table depends on the five pieces of wood and the work that went into making them what they are. In fact, the table depends on all the components of its history, which, if you're a Buddhist, means from time without beginning. And that is all the table consists of. There's not one bit of table, not even an atom, that exists as a table without depending on or being part of the accumulated history and parts that make up the table. Buddha said that all phenomena made up of other things and dependent on other things are in the nature of constant change. Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche, who wrote the book What Makes You Not a Buddhist, I mentioned last week, puts it like this: without a single scientific tool, Prince Siddhartha sat on a patch of kusa grass beneath Figus religiosa tree, investigating human nature. After a long time of contemplation, he came to the realization that all form, including our flesh and bones, and all our emotions and all our perceptions, are assembled. They are the product of two or more things coming together. When any two components or more come together, a new phenomenon emerges. Nails and wood become a table. Water and leaves become tea. Fear, devotion, and a savior become God. This end product doesn't have an existence independent of its parts. Believing it truly exists independently is the greatest deception. Meanwhile, the parts have undergone change. Just by meeting, their character has changed, and together they have become something else. They are compounded. Prince Siddhartha realized that this applies not only to the human experience, but to all matter, the entire world, the universe, because everything is interdependent, everything is subject to change. No one component in all creation exists in an autonomous, permanent, pure state. This may be the fact pure and simple, but because we do not want to recognize it, we do everything in our power not to acknowledge this reality, we undergo endless suffering. But again, we'll go into this a bit later. The second seal is all contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. When we hear about contaminated phenomena, we might think of things that have come into contact with bluebottle flies and cockroaches, but that's not quite what the Buddha meant. When he spoke about contaminated phenomena, the Buddha was referring to those phenomena arising out of ignorance and disturbing emotions. Basically, as I mentioned above, we experience ourselves and other things as if they all existed inherently from their own side, independent from other things. When I think of myself without analyzing, I have a sense that some inherent independent person called Tenzin exists. And when I look at the world around me, I see a whole lot of things that also seem independent of everything else. The table appears to me as if it's a real table, not dependent on its accumulated history, the parts that make it up, and the mind that labels it table. This is the ignorance that's referred to in the second seal. Now, when we see ourselves and things in this way, we develop emotional reactions. Due to our accumulated history, our habitual and social conditioning, and strongly referring to this independent, inherently existing self, we are attracted to some things and repelled by others. We also have a neutral attitude to some things. If we look carefully at such emotions, we see that they disturb our mental peace and calm. When we are attracted to something or someone, the mind becomes excited and develops a kind of yearning and a longing not to be without that thing or person. If, however, we are repelled by something else, our mental peace is disturbed by a desire to push it away, to be free of it. And a neutral attitude means we act with complete indifference and disregard to the object or person. What I have described here are, of course, the three major emotional reactions we experience, although many others have the same capacity to disturb our mind's serenity. This multitude makes up the swarms of emotional bluebottle flies and cockroaches that cause our suffering. Talking about the Buddha just before he became enlightened, Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche says in his book, "He explored suffering with an open mind, and through his tireless contemplation, Siddhartha discovered that at the root it is our emotions that lead to suffering. In fact, they are suffering." He goes on to say, "If you examine emotions as Siddhartha did, if you try to identify their origin, you will find that they are rooted in misunderstanding and thus fundamentally flawed. All emotions are basically a form of prejudice. Within each emotion, there is always an element of judgment." So when the second seal says all contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering, it means phenomena that arise out of our misunderstanding how things exist and the emotional defilements that contaminate our reactions and actions. The third seal is all phenomena are selfless. Of course, this is the very linchpin of Buddhist thought. Although there is some debate amongst the Buddhist schools of philosophy about the exact meaning of selflessness, all agree that we lack a permanent independent self. Basically, this means that reality exists in a way opposite to the way we grasp it. As I said before, we see things in ourselves as existing inherently and independently. In other words, as having a self that is not dependent on anything else. This is a fundamental error because nothing exists without depending on other things. Practically nothing exists permanently. And everything that exists dependent on other things is in the nature of constant change. As we noted in the first seal, all compounded phenomena are impermanent. Anything made up of two or more things changes instantaneously. So, if it's all change, what is there to define as the permanent, inherently existing self? As soon as you point to something, it immediately changes, like smoke. So it can't have a permanent, inherently existing self, as we think it does. The fourth seal, Nirvana is peace, points to the ultimate realization that all things are selfless, or without any vestige of independent, inherent existence. It is not enough to realize this nature of reality just through intellect. We must realize it directly and intuitively, so that when we look at things, we no longer grasp them at all as having real inherent existence. We see them for the constantly changing collection of causes, conditions, and parts, given a label by mind, which they are. They come together, but even in that instant of coming together, they are moving inevitably towards their disintegration and becoming something else. Once we see reality in that way, all the disturbing emotions based on our previous misunderstanding melt away, never to return. And we attain the state that the Buddha set out to find. Dzongsa Khenpo Rinpoche says we should not think of this state as a state of happiness. He says it's beyond that because it has nothing to do with the dualism of happiness or unhappiness. He writes, even though happiness is considered a mere concept, Buddhist texts still use terms like great bliss to describe enlightenment. Nirvana can indeed be understood as a joyful state because having no confusion and no ignorance, no happiness and no unhappiness is bliss. Seeing the source of confusion and ignorance as never having existed is even better. You feel great relief when you awaken from a nightmare, but bliss would be to never have dreamed in the first place. In this sense, bliss is not the same as happiness. Siddhartha emphasized to his followers the futility of seeking peace and happiness in this world or in the afterlife if they were serious about freeing themselves from samsara. And now we've gone quite briefly through the four seals in an effort to define what we mean by a follower of the Buddha. With that background then, let's look a bit more closely at what we have to do to get on the path to enlightenment. If someone with only a vague inkling of Buddhism wanted to find out more and asked me how to start on the Buddhist path, I guess I would have to say, first find the tradition that most suits your way of thinking, and then find a good teacher. When I first came to Buddhism in 1989 in Auckland, there were not many temples. I think there was a Thai forest tradition temple in Mount Wellington, Tibetan temples in Herne Bay and Kaukaupapa, and a Vipassana group ran courses and meditations also at Kaukaupapa. A Zen group met at St. John's as well, but that was about all. Now, though, the city is full of Buddhist temples and groups. The flood of Asian immigrants in the 90s brought many cultures and their various religions to the city, and now it's easy to find the temples of Thai, Tibetan, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Zen, Sri Lankan, Chinese, and any other Buddhist group you wish to mention. Not to forget the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, a Buddhist organization geared particularly for the Western mind. Hamilton still doesn't have that many temples. The one I'm staying in at Silverdale and two Cambodian temples, though groups with Buddhist affiliations do meet, I understand, at various places in the city. Although the various traditions all follow the Buddha's teachings, practices and emphasis differ, and a newcomer may find one tradition's practices and way of doing things more conducive to his or her mind than another. So it's good in the beginning to read up about the various traditions and to visit their temples before committing to any one tradition. I think Zen has attracted many Westerners, for instance, and Tibetan Buddhism, perhaps because of the fame of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is also becoming increasingly popular in the West. Anyway, in any tradition, a good teacher is most important. But isn't that true of anything we want to learn? Very occasionally, somebody will come along who doesn't seem to need a teacher in their chosen field, like Mozart, who started composing from the age of 5. But most of us have to find a teacher if we want to learn something. I guess it is possible to study algebraic calculus on your own, but it would definitely be much easier if you had some hotshot mathematical genius to explain it to you, provided they could teach well, of course. If that is true of ordinary subjects like maths and music, imagine how much more necessary a teacher would be if you wanted to learn how to attain enlightenment. So our first step has to be to find someone who can explain in some depth what the Buddha was going on about and also instruct us in meditation. Because as I said in our previous program, meditation is the main Buddhist method to transform the mind. If someone can explain the Buddha's teachings well but doesn't know how to practice, Buddhism becomes just another intellectual exercise. It may be entertaining and even illuminating, but it will hardly make our lives much better. In the Tibetan tradition, the spiritual teacher is regarded as the most important person in one's life, even more important than one's mother and father. Although our parents are extremely kind, giving us life and looking after us until we can look after ourselves, they usually don't have the capacity to lead us to enlightenment. That is the job of the spiritual teacher. And that is why such a teacher is regarded so highly. However, as I mentioned in our last program, we have to be very careful in choosing a teacher. Quite a few of the Eastern teachers who came out to the West in the middle of the last century, when Buddhism started catching on in the USA and Europe, behaved quite badly when they came in contact with the West's rich materialism and the adoration of young students. So even if a teacher has a great reputation and is extremely charismatic, perhaps especially if a teacher has these attributes, we have to be careful about forming a relationship with them. It's really not good enough to rely on someone just on the recommendation of a whole lot of other people, no matter how impressive a teacher may appear or how much we are initially attracted to them. Basing their choice on such unstable grounds has led people to put themselves in very serious trouble. Now, as you know, Buddhism is very particular about morality. In the Theravadan tradition, among the lay people, it is common to take the 5 precepts almost daily, and we are constantly encouraged to take and keep vows. Morality is especially important for a good Buddhist teacher. This is perhaps the first thing we should look for. If the teacher is a monk, it should be comparatively easy to see how well they keep their vows. For instance, if a monk lurks around the movies and chats to girls, you would probably not think of him as someone to rely on. It may be a bit more difficult to decide about a layperson, though. Still, there's no hurry in deciding on your spiritual advisor. It's better to go for a long time checking someone out before trusting yourself to them. Another thing to look forward for in a spiritual teacher is a concentrated mind. You know how easy it is to act on impulse and sometimes to regret doing so. Actually, it's easy for a distracted mind to act on impulse. It's always following one impulse or another. A concentrated mind, on the other hand, stays alert to what is going on and is able to counteract impulses that lead to actions which lead to regret. For instance, what is your immediate reaction when a mosquito lands on your arm? To swat it? Of course, to a Buddhist, any killing is wrong action. But if you have taken a precept not to kill and then automatically swat the mosquito, you have both created the negative karma of killing as well as broken your precept. A person with a concentrated mind would be able to control any impulse like killing the mosquito and so be careful about their morality. So, if we see a teacher has a concentrated mind, always alert to the way they behave, we can have some confidence in them. Then, of course, a teacher should have a good experiential understanding of the nature of reality. He or she must be able to infallibly point us in the right direction when we're trying to change our mindset and the way we view things. If the teacher has a wrong view or even a partial idea of how things really exist, how can he or she show us what to look for? Actually, when meditating on the nature of reality, we can make some quite major mistakes. So it's important that the teacher really understands what they're talking about from their own experience. This is why the meditation on the nature of reality comes right at the end of the path to enlightenment, rather than at the beginning. Even though the explanation of the nature of reality is the main point of all the Buddha's teaching, all the other meditations are like a preparation for the meditation on the nature of reality, to prepare the mind for it. That then means the teacher must also be very familiar with everything that leads up to this final meditation. In other words, the teacher must be familiar with the whole coverage of Buddha's teachings. The Buddha gave 84,000 teachings, so only a very highly realized person would be able to know everything the Buddha taught. But someone we take as our teacher should have a very sound overview of the teachings with a large scriptural knowledge. Otherwise, how could they lead us on the whole path? They may be able to take us part of the way, but not all the way to enlightenment. So, of course, that means the teacher must know more than the students, even if the students are very well read and know a lot. What else should we look for in a teacher? Well, he or she must know how to teach. When you were at school or university, you probably came across teachers or lecturers who really knew their subject inside out, but were hopeless at explaining it to the students. People just went to sleep in their class. Actually, I think in some Buddhist traditions, although monks are taught and understand the Buddhist sutras very well, they're never taught how to teach. So when they're put in front of a crowd of devotees, some people just easily switch off. When we look for a teacher, we should make sure that every time we are in class with them, they don't turn us into zombies. A book by Geshe Lodin called Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism says, "It is necessary that he have a great skill in explaining the Dharma, so that he is able to teach according to the different needs and capabilities of his students. He should use examples and quotations that are relevant and give reasons with the greatest impact." Just because Geshe Lodin talks about a he as the teacher, a highly realized teacher can, of course, be of either sex. Your teacher is not defined by gender. Then the motivation of the teacher is also very important. How many times have you heard of people with great reputations as gurus living extremely luxurious lives, having gathered as much money as they could from their students? It's not so common amongst Buddhist teachers, though I have heard of one Tibetan teacher who was appointed to a Dharma center in the States, I think it was, who was so focused on collecting money for his family back in India or Tibet that eventually the students of the center asked him to leave. But if a teacher's motivation for teaching the Dharma is merely to live a luxurious life or to gain a lot of fame as a teacher, we have to be very careful in accepting them as our guide. To be a worthwhile spiritual guide, a teacher's motivation has to be focused on the welfare of the students. Buddha himself provided us with an example. Even though he had every opportunity after his enlightenment to live a rich and famous life, he chose to wander the country as a renunciate, still begging for his food as he taught those who wanted to learn from him. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes I have to be told something 100 times before it begins to click, especially with a Dharma. Imagine then having a teacher who thinks you're an idiot if you don't get it the first or second time and just gets impatient if you ask a third time. I had this kind of experience once when attending a teaching with a visiting monk. I had difficulty with something he was explaining, even after he explained it a couple of times. Eventually he said to me, "Go away and think about it some more." That, I thought, was the silliest answer he could have given me. So the point here is that a good teacher will be ready to go over a tricky point or subject again and again, trying different ways of explaining until the student gets it. I think this is true even in a school of kids. Some need a lot more explanation than others, and a good teacher will take the time to give that explanation. In other words, a teacher needs a lot of patience. So, if you want to know what to look for when you need a spiritual teacher, those are the qualities: high moral standards, a controlled and concentrated mind, an excellent knowledge of the nature of reality, an equally excellent knowledge of all the Buddha's teachings, a good motivation focused on the students, skill in learning, and a patience that will put up with a lot of explanation. Find such a person and you'll be well on the way to having a good spiritual guide. It might seem that to find a person with all these qualities is actually quite difficult. And that would be true. Even finding a teacher with such qualities for ordinary worldly subjects is difficult enough. If you can't find a teacher with all those qualities, then it is said try and find one that at least has good morality, a concentrated mind, wisdom regarding the nature of reality, and patience and compassion for the students. If this is too difficult, a teacher must at least have more qualities than faults, more concern for others than him or herself, and more interest in future lives than this one. That's all very well. We might find the right teacher, but we might not be the right student. Sometimes a teacher will not accept a person as their student, even though they ask many times. I heard a story of a Chinese person in ancient times who wanted to be a student of the patriarch of a Chinese Buddhist tradition. This patriarch had a reputation as a very highly realized being. The student camped outside the gate of the patriarch's monastery, begging to be accepted, but the patriarch consistently refused him. Eventually, the patriarch told the man he would be accepted as a student if he chopped off his right arm. The student duly hacked off his right arm and was accepted as the patriarch's student. And now time is up. I hope the program has been of benefit. Please dedicate any positive energy from this program to gaining enlightenment, not only to benefit yourself, but all others as well. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll do so again next week. Until then, goodbye.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.